The sacred land, it has seen many hands, it has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old, and now the greedy souls just don't care to know all the changes it will confront. So you know some people, they just won't understand, or just won't understand these things. Thank you for your message, but I don't understand.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Andrew Revkin, who is a reporter for the New York Times and creator of the paper's .earth blog, where he's covered global environmental issues that have included climate change, Hurricane Katrina, the Asia tsunami, science policy and politics, and the North Pole. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Revkin.
It's good to be with you.
And you also have an article in the New York Times, Obama and Romney, Oil and Science, apropos last night's second presidential debate. A lot of talk about oil, coal, gas, wind, solar. No talk about climate change.
Well, it isn't a surprise, although, as you may have seen, there's been some coverage that Candy Crowley, at the very end, after the debate was over, was chatting about the fact that she almost fit in a question on climate change. So it seemed to be there was someone in the audience who had one to ask. But, you know, that kind of reflects the reality that this is still not even remotely a voting booth issue for Americans. So if you're a politician and you have limited time, and frankly, if you're a CNN host of a debate and you have limited time and you got this long list of issues, the ones that dominate are people's minds or just don't include this. And, you know, whether or not we're facing a future of the powerfully transformed climate, the character of the problem is not the kind of thing that fits well into what we think about when we get into the political arena.
Well, you've written your latest book, Andrew Revkin, is The North Pole Was Here, Puzzles and Perils at the Top of the World. There have been some photographs showing the depletion of the ice caps on the North Pole that are so graphic that you'd think it would have gotten a lot of people's attention. So what explains this lag between the objective information that's out there that the climate is changing, and after all, people in this country have experienced record heat and drought and hurricanes and tornadoes and floods. What's the resistance here to reality?
Well, some of it is a function of what sociologists describe as shifting baselines of perception. In other words, one generation is born with a different sense of normal than the previous generation. On the Arctic, I grew up with the Arctic being a forbidding, froze icy landscape. And when I went there in 2003 to the North Pole in the early spring, you know, there was still the sea ice cloaking the Arctic Ocean was a lot thicker than it is now. But people, kids today, you know, young people born today are born with the norm that the Arctic is a system in flux, that polar bears are a species in peril. That was not the only peril that was facing polar bears when I was a kid was the hunting. Unrestricted hunting. So things change. Perception has changed. Now, on the other front, in terms of extreme weather, polling has shown recently that there is more of a public consciousness that the warming climate is related to extreme weather. But the problem there is the science is very complicated. Tornadoes, for example, the warmer and drier the United States is, the fewer tornadoes we've had. In fact, we've had a tornado drought, if you can imagine such a thing, along with the actual physically climatological drought this summer. So it's not like, you know, the whole climate system is coming unglued. Everything that you see that's abnormal is caused by greenhouse gases. And so that doesn't create a groundswell. You know, even so scientists can't even honestly say that everything extreme is our fault, which makes it a complex issue. And again, that's something that doesn't end up being front and center. And there, I could go on, but that's a good start.
Again, I'm speaking with Andrew Revkin, who is a reporter for the New York Times and creator of the paper's .earth blog, where he's covered global environmental issues that have included climate change, Hurricane Katrina, the Asian tsunami, science policy and politics, and the North Pole. He's the author of Global Warming, Understanding the Forecast, and The North Pole Was Here, Puzzles and Perils at the Top of the World. Obviously, in terms of pocketbook politics, what came up in the debate last night between President Obama and Mitt Romney was the price of gas, and I guess that's the bottom line in this argument, isn't it? And I guess are we just simply not mature enough as a political audience to get the understanding that as oil is depleted, it becomes more expensive, and therefore the price of the pump will inevitably go up. So if we made a small investment here, say an extra tax on what gas we have now, that would fast track us to the alternative, so we wouldn't be reliant on this diminishing resource.
Well, you know, I wrote about this today on .earth, and the realities are that Obama tried to pivot in his part of that discussion toward conservation, and he brought up the doubling of mileage standards for vehicles and the need for research, and that's when Romney came in with what I saw as a ridiculous sort of mantra: government doesn't create jobs. Government doesn't create jobs. That was his only response to the line about the need for re-intensifying our research on science frontiers to make us more competitive. And I just think that you're right in terms of the maturity factor. It's not just sort of about our voting behavior, but you know, as a species, yet we're still a young species. We're on a planet where we've just become aware in the last couple of decades, really, that we're becoming a very potent force among the other forces out there that are natural and potent. And we haven't really developed the capacity, I think, yet to shift our short-term behaviors in favor of long-term, modulating long-term risks. It's just not, and this goes even to diet, you know, it's very hard to divert to the apple from the cookie when you're reaching for something. We have that tendency to still to go with our instincts and our first, and that usually draws us to things that are near and things that are now. And climate change, again, is mostly about global scale policy questions, and it doesn't really fit well with the imperative of, you know, having your budget balanced and your car functional now.
Well, of course, the reality of politics is money that undergirds all of politics. And since the Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United, there's nothing but tons of money flowing in. And in the 2010 election that caught the Democrats by surprise, the biggest single donor to the Republicans in that was the American Petroleum Institute. And they, along with the coal industry, are pouring money into Mitt Romney's coffers. There's a tremendous contest going in some of the swing states that are also coal states, in Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and in particular Ohio. There's, you know, lawn signs all over the place that Obama is trying to put you out of work if you're a coal miner. And Romney, of course, is playing that to the hilt. How do we get around the? I mean, do you think this is just going to be taken care of by market factors? The fact that there's so much fracking going on that the price of gas is getting lower and lower, which by the way, the president mentioned, and that's going to make coal less competitive, or in other words, is that going to happen, or is the EPA going to get tough on coal as the conservatives are charging?
Well, I think you're seeing already the shift from coal in pretty rapidly in our mix of energy choices here and toward gas, and a big chunk of that is certainly driven by the abundance and low price of gas, but some of it's also driven by tightening regulations on power plants and. Those have been politically acceptable. There are costs, as George Romney said, including it came up in the debate, I think, this is when he was governor. You know, he talked about the deadly impact of coal pollution, and so there is a broad base of support for, at the very least, cleaning up our coal combustion and certainly becoming more efficient how we use it, and then eventually moving away from it, even leaving it in the ground, heaven forbid. As the other issues like climate develop more of an imperative. And the same thing could happen in China. I wrote about this on .earth. You know, China has a huge amount of natural gas as well. If they get into gear with that, you could see, because of the pollution, the direct pollution impacts, a switch there as well. So these things will be driven by the market and by. But keep in mind that, you know, what happened with gas is really a function of innovation. That there was, whether you love or hate fracking, it's a set of technologies that was ingeniously put together to get gas out of rock that was presumed to be untappable. And that's what we do. When things, one thing gets scarce, we move to another thing, and that could happen if, you know, with breakthroughs, if we reinvest at least some money into basic research on energy frontiers relating to non-polluting sources, you know, going beyond gas to renewables or new forms of nuclear, then you could see this happen again and again. But we right now we're so disinvested in R&D. One point I made in my piece on Dot Earth was that while Obama brought up the word science and the need for invigorating our research effort here on science frontiers as an underpinning of economic growth, the reality is this country on energy research has been in a slumber party, I call it, for multi-generations, a bipartisan slumber party. That you look at the disinvestment level and you see that Republican or Democratic administrations or Congresses are irrelevant, and that without that changing, without a leader coming forward and saying that this is an imperative, this is the American mission for this century, or at least a big one, then there's a great missed opportunity, and it's not costly either.
Well, obviously it didn't come up in the debate, but you would think that the president would be on firm ground running against the United States Congress, the House in particular, I should say, who have, I think, 8% approval ratings. And in terms, he did mention how much of what he's tried to do has gotten blocked in the House and filibustered in the Senate. But one of the things I find just mind-boggling, if not shameful, is that so many members on the House Science Committee are global warming deniers. You've got Congressman Brown from Georgia, who gave a speech at a church recently about how presumably the dinosaurs were cohabiting with all the other animals on Noah's Ark and that the Earth is 9,000 years old. You've got Sensenbrenner, and of course you've got Todd Akin, who is the man that believes in legitimate rape and a woman's body rejecting unwanted pregnancies. So this is a, to me, I think, one just can only scratch your head to think the cynicism of putting these people on this committee. But there you have it.
Yeah. Well, that is the real blockade. You know, we have a system set up here where, in the Senate particularly, a very small coalition of from the far right can sort of hold things up. And you need a 60-vote supermajority to get anything meaningful done. And one reason I've, in my own writing, I've shifted away from looking at Washington as the source of solutions here is that that's a reality that's not going away anytime soon.
But when you mentioned fracking earlier and the innovation involved in fracking, of getting extracting gas from shale, obviously the consequences of that aren't well known. The Science Committee, again, they gave the EPA a hard time when they were testifying over what was happening to groundwater in Montana. It seems that this becomes a case of choosing one's poison. I mean, and what I find particularly disturbing about the defense of coal, and Obama brought up this canard of clean coal, saying how much the U.S. government has invested in it. But what he didn't say is that the coal companies are the ones that promote clean coal as a reality when it's not, and they haven't invested a dime in it. Yet they take credit for something that doesn't exist.
Yeah. It's there again. It's hard for me to disagree with you. I've written about it's like fantasy baseball. Clean coal in the context of climate change is truly now just a fantasy and a pipe dream, as I've called it before.
Well, that leads me to another pipe, and that's the Keystone arguments that came up last night. How did you think? It's obvious that that Romney feels he's on strong ground, talking about the price of gas and the big government getting in the way of private enterprise, and all we need is just to tap what we have in North America, and suddenly we'll have cheap gas again. That is a much more appealing argument, albeit a completely fraudulent one. How did you think he fared against Obama's cautious embrace of alternatives?
Well, there again, neither candidate really got into the reality that oil markets are global, and that as long as the price of oil is in the kind of $100 a barrel range, whether we get it from the tar sands of Canada or from equally marginal areas and polluting areas in Nigeria or Venezuela or elsewhere, the demand will guarantee we'll be going to the ends of the earth to get this substance. So, to me, this is where Obama's statement, which is pretty sophisticated and hard to kind of get through in the noise of a debate about the need for conservation, for dropping, cutting demand for oil. If you don't cut demand for oil, and there's just no way you can, the Keystone debate itself to me was a distraction, and really, because again, as I said, you know, it's all about demand. If the price is high enough, we're going to get that oil from somewhere, and that the higher the price, the more marginal the sources. And you know, I think it's actually sort of it's hypocritical to say it matters that it's a polluting source in Canada when we're not considering the polluting sources in Nigeria and elsewhere as well.
Well, Andrew Revkin, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Andrew Revkin, who is a reporter for The New York Times and creator of the New York Times' .earth blog, where he has covered global environmental issues that have included climate change, Hurricane Katrina, the Asian tsunami, science policy and politics, and the North Pole. His books include Global Warming, Understanding the Forecast, and The North Pole Was Here, Puzzles and Perils at the Top of the World. He has an article at The New York Times, Obama and Romney, Oil and Science. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Tariq Mohammed. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments, and the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.